Anatomy and Physiology, the Reproductive Systems and Development, Part 1. As you know, I like to start my PowerPoints off with general overview slides, and I'm going to start here with an overview of some of the major functions of the reproductive systems. We can look below at the drawings to begin with. On your lower left is an overview of the male reproductive system, and on your lower right, a similar sagittal section, a drawing of the female reproductive system. But what's the big picture? What's the purposes of the reproductive systems? Number one, it says formation of gametes, which may unite in an event called fertilization. In other words, function number one is of the reproductive systems is to reproduce. Gametes, we'll learn, they just mean in a male, that's the sperm, and in the female, that's an egg cell. So maybe the sperm and the egg cell will get together in a process called fertilization and make a baby. So function number one is to reproduce. And function number two is a big function as well, production of hormones. And as we know, hormones control most processes in the human body. We'll take a look in this first unit at the male reproductive system, and then in the second half, we'll look at the female reproductive system. The male reproductive system overall, I think, is a lot easier. It's mostly just parts as parts. This is the overview slide of all the parts. Don't get nervous on this slide. It's just sort of the laundry list. We'll take a look at each of these things one at a time, but let's talk about them starting at the top very briefly. We will review the testes, also called the testicles. Those are the male gonads. The gonads are where the seeds are made, so to speak. Then will come a series of ducts. These ducts we'll look at in that order that you see on this slide are just to carry the sperm along its journey from where they begin to where they maybe finish their journey. Then we'll talk about a series of accessory sex glands. You've heard that term before. Accessory glands or organs are usually things that help the main thing, and in this case, our accessory male sex glands will in general shoot some kind of a juice into the ductwork to help the sperm stay safe and healthy along its journey. Then there are some structures that are merely classified as supporting structures according to your book, and those are the penis, the scrotum, and the spermatic cord. So that's sort of like a postscript, if you will, at the end of this slide. But let's take a look at each of these things in detail and break them down. I love to show gross anatomy pictures. I hope you're enjoying these as much as I do. I throw them in all throughout the course. So here is a sagittal section through a cadaver showing many of the things we're about to look at. Let's start with the scrotum. This is classified as one of those supporting structures. What is the scrotum? Basically, it's just a sack of loose skin with hair and some smooth muscle that surrounds the testes. But what you probably didn't know is actually it's kind of really two sacks, because there's a little piece of dividing tissue called the scrotal septum that goes right up the middle and divides the scrotum into two individual sacs, each containing one testis. So each testicle has its private own little home within the scrotum, so to speak. And the word septum should help you, by the way. You know septum just means a divider. It's seen in many places in anatomy. And here it's a divider in the scrotum. So why are the testicles hanging low? I mean, and they're just hanging there for no good reason at all? Of course not. The design, once again, matches the mission. There's a reason the testicles with their sperm are hanging low. It's because sperm survival requires a 2 to 3 degrees centigrade temperature lower than body temperature. We have to keep them cool as they are developing, and we'll learn the critical reasons why that's so important on the up and coming slides. So there's a reason why they're hanging low. To understand how the scrotum works, we have to understand some muscles that are within the scrotum. The two muscles we'll study are called the dartos and the cremaster muscles. Let's start with the dartos muscle. The dartos muscle, I'll try to trace. It's shown here as a light pink color. It is smooth muscle that's both in the scrotal septum and also in the subcutaneous tissue of the scrotum. I just remember the dartos is deep to the dermis, and that helps my pea brain to remember this. And the other muscle you have to know, I'll trace here, is called the cremaster muscle. And check this out. It's actually skeletal muscle that is continuous with the internal oblique muscles of the abdomen in a man. And the cremaster muscle goes down and connects to each testis. It's kind of like a crank or a chain. So when I think of the cremaster muscle, I think of it like a crank or a chain that's attached to each testicle. So how does it work? Well, to keep the sperm as they're developing at the proper temperature in the testicles, the dartos and the cremaster muscles will contract in response to cold temperatures, and that will elevate the testicles to warm them up if they need to be a little bit warmer. And if the temperature is warm, then the dartos and cremaster muscles will relax and let the testicles drop further away from the core of the body where they can be cooled down a little bit. Again, all the muscles do are raise and lower the testicles to keep the sperm at that proper temperature at a couple of degrees lower than body temperature. While you're making some notes, I want to tell you something that's clinically significant and something you have to know. There is a disorder called cryptorchidism. And what that is in English is undescended testicles. On another slide, I'll mention that testicles, while we're in the womb and developing, start out in the upper abdominal pelvic cavity, up near the kidneys actually, and they slowly descend. Usually around the 7th month or so, they descend through a little tunnel and drop down into the scrotal sac. But in some babies, that doesn't happen. And again, we call that undescended testicles. The problem is they're too warm in that body location. And undescended testicles, it occurs in about 3% of full-term male babies, and it occurs in about 30% of premature male babies. And the problem is, if they stay hung up in the body cavity and the sperm are too warm while they're trying to develop, the male is at risk for 2 serious disorders I would like you to write down. Number one, the man will be probably sterile. So sterility is a risk of undescended testicles. And just as concerning, undescended testicles can lead to testicular cancer. A man who has undescended testicles has about a 30 to 50 times higher chance of having testicular cancer if the testicles don't descend into the scrotum as they're supposed to. You should know that. You should write it down. Obviously, these are 2 very serious disorders for a man. And by the way, if the testicles do not descend into the scrotal sac by a certain period of time, I don't know what the current time frame is. It used to be by about 18 months or so. But in any case, what is done is you take the testicles and surgically you physically take them and you put them down into the scrotal sac in order to try to prevent sterility and testicular cancer. So yes, this is important stuff. It's real life stuff. That reminds me of a true story. When I was in college, it was really bizarre. I had this dream that I was drowning while I was surfing, and I woke up from my dream and I really couldn't breathe. They rushed me to the emergency room and my tonsils were so swollen, they collapsed my airway. There's actually a name for that. It's called kissing tonsils. There was just a slit about the size of a piece of paper between my tonsils, and I was literally asphyxiating, and they rushed me to the OR. They took out my tonsils. Tonsil surgery, by the way, can be very bloody surgery. As you might recall, tonsils are not organs. They don't have capsules. So a risk of taking tonsils out is bleeding. I did have post-operative bleeding afterwards. Most of that was my fault because after I woke up from surgery, I had all these smart-aleck comments I thought were cute that I was going to say to the nurses. But the joke was on me because I bursted open a blood vessel and they rushed me back to the OR for some cautery. But what I'm trying to get to is when they brought me back to my hospital bed, there was this guy laying next to me in his 20s, and I recognized him from high school. And, you know, I thought I was big and bad and tough, you know. And I said, hey, man, I just had my tonsils out, you know. It was real complicated surgery, a lot of bleeding. I said, what about you? And he said, oh, I'm in here for testicular cancer. I just had one of my testicles removed. That really put things into perspective. By the way, testicular cancer, that's one of those things, if you catch it early, for example, with self-exams, a lot of men's lives could be saved with early detection and treatment. Let's talk more about the testicles or the testes. They are synonyms, by the way. They are paired oval glands, and as we've been discussing, usually before birth, they descend through a little canal in a man's anterior abdominal wall called the inguinal canal. I like that name, inguinal canal, because it sounds like and it means the in the groin canal. And then hopefully the testicles plop down into the scrotum. Each testis is surrounded by a thick, tough, white connective tissue capsule called the tunica albuginea. Tunica means coat. Albi means white. It is a thick white coat. If you ever have dissected one in the lab or were involved in surgery on a real human being, you see that even on the cat, to cut through that tunica albuginea is a lot tougher than you think. Up above in this figure is a drawing of the testicle. It's a sagittal section. Here is anterior. Back here is posterior, and the bottom of the figure is the real deal. It's kind of neat to see the testicle down here, and you can see the tunica albuginea, the nice white coat on top of it as well. So just a little gross anatomy thrown in there to look at for your enjoyment. A little bit more detail on the testes. If we cross-section a testicle, again, a sagittal section, here's anterior, here's posterior. What you see is that the testicle is really divided into little compartments. The testes are divided by these connective tissue collagen separating deals, once again called septae, and the septae divide the testicle into compartments called lobules. Within each lobule, there are about 1 to 3 tubules where the sperm are formed, and they are called the seminiferous tubules. And I like that name, seminiferous. Semen means seed, fer, as in transfer, by the way, means to carry. So literally, they're called the seed-carrying tubules in Greek, so I really like that name. That always reminds me of that movie, very funny movie, at least in my opinion, called My Big Fat Greek Wedding, and there was this very proud Greek grandfather who always called anybody who came to see him in the household to talk with them, and he would challenge that person to bring them any word, and he would always bring that word back to its Greek origin, which we can almost always do here in anatomy as well. So yes, the Greek heritage is a very proud one indeed, and it's the root to almost all of our words that we're using here, as well as Latin, of course. Here we get into some more detail. So off to your left is, again, a portion of a seminiferous tubule. Here's the basement membrane that would really go around in a great big circle. Here are some of the cells within the tubule. And then down here where my arrow is the lumen of the tubule. If I ask you, what is inside the seminiferous tubule? You will tell me there are two main things. Number one, what we mostly see here are all the stages of developing sperm cells. We'll discuss that formation in order. They include a stem cell called spermatogonium, then a primary spermatocyte, followed by a secondary spermatocyte, a spermatid, and finally a mature sperm cell. Besides developing sperm cells, the other things that are inside the seminiferous tubule are supporting cells that I'm tracing on now called Sertoli cells, S-E-R-T-O-L-I. They are so important. I have a whole separate slide on them coming up next. So let's talk about the all-important supporting cells of sperm formation called Sertoli cells. First of all, a very funky shaped cell. Let me try to outline it. It extends all the way from the basement membrane to the lumen of the tubule. Very large, very weird shape. And it's a supporting cell. And yes, supporting cells, they support, they protect, they nourish. And they do some very special things here inside the testicles. For example, they control movements of the developing sperm cells so that they develop sperm properly. I make this analogy. When I was growing up in high school, during the summer one time, I had a job on an assembly line. And on the assembly line, we actually were making Japanese beetle bug traps. And everyone on the line had a very specific job to do. And if you didn't do your job right, or if the assembly line got going too fast, everything would get all bungled up. And what did we put out at the end of the assembly line? We put out junk. And you don't want to put out any junk at the end of the assembly line. So one of the jobs of the Sertoli cell is to control the movement so we have a nice, orderly, correct development of healthy sperm cells. And one specific way that the Sertoli cell has to do this is by secreting a hormone called inhibin. And I love that name, inhibin. Doesn't it sound like inhibit? Because that's exactly what it's going to do. Inhibin slows down sperm production by decreasing another hormone, you remember, from the anterior pituitary called FSH. So this is beautiful. We have a way to slow things down so that at the end of the assembly line, we put out a good product. The other wonderful thing that the Sertoli cell does is it protects the developing sperm by forming something called the blood testis barrier that I have a red star next to on this slide. Because here's the deal. If you looked ahead, you already know the answer to this question. When do males start producing sperm? Is it before birth, at birth, puberty? What is it? And it's at puberty. So in other words, a man doesn't even make a sperm cell until puberty. So if you think back to immunology, this might start to click with you a little bit. You might be thinking, hey, wait a minute. If all of a sudden my body starts making a cell after my immune system has already trained all the lymphocytes to be able to go out and hunt and kill and attack and so forth, any foreign invaders, and then all of a sudden at puberty this new cell, of course with new proteins on its surface, shows up, what do you think your immune system would do to that new cell if you didn't have a way to protect it. Your immune system would attack it with antibodies, with killer T cells. So the Sertoli cell protects it from the immune system by something we call a blood testis barrier. And you will see men who have a problem with this. In some men, this breaks down and they start attacking their own sperm. There's a name for that immune disorder. It's just not on the top of my mind right now. I'm drawing a blank on that. But you will possibly see that. I saw at least one case in my lifetime. Let's continue our examination of the testes. And we already finished what the basics are inside the seminiferous tubules. Now we're going to look at the tissue spaces that are in between the seminiferous tubules. And there we have some blood capillaries, but also we have some other cells shown here in green. These are not inside the seminiferous tubules. They're in between the tubules. And I love the name given to these cells. They are often called interstitial cells. And I love the name because inter means in between. And they're in between the tubules. The more common name that's used in the real world that you need to know are Leydig cells. So Leydig cells and interstitial cells are synonyms. They mean the same things. And these cells are critical. These are the cells where the man makes testosterone, if anybody ever asks you. And what a beautiful setup. It just so turns out, we'll see that one of several hormones that sperm need to grow up is testosterone. So what a beautiful design that we have the Leydig cells sitting right here next door making testosterone, give a little squirt of that, eventually lands on the nearby developing sperm cells and helps them to grow up. Once again, the design matches the mission. By the way, you will see people once again with testicular cancer. Most often the testicular cancer is of the developing sperm cells, but some men develop tumors of the Leydig cell, and it will come back on the pathology report as a Leydig cell tumor. So please be prepared for that. We now have to talk about how we actually create or form sperm cells. The term is spermatogenesis. Let your root word help you. Genesis means to make or create. Sperm means sperm. So how to make a sperm? Again, let me orient you on what your book did. On the top, we have a cross section of one seminiferous tubule in bright pink. We have the outer basement membrane. On the inside, we see all the cells, which are mostly developing sperm cells, as well as some Sertoli cells. And then in the middle, we have the lumen. Down below, we have a high power section of just a portion of that tubule. Again, the basement membrane shown in a light orange pinky color. And then the cells down below, and finally the lumen of the tubule where my arrow is now. To be able to understand spermatogenesis in a male, and also to be able to understand egg formation in a female, we have to understand a type of cell division called meiosis. Many of you may have already studied that in an earlier biology course in great detail. I'm just going to hit on the highlights that you need to know for this part of this course. To start with, it is commonly referred to as reproductive cell division. It only takes place in the gonads, which are the male testicles and the female ovaries. The big picture point here is the whole end game of meiosis is to produce gametes, which is the male's sperm and the female egg, that have half the number of normal chromosomes. What is half, by the way? Half, there are different terms for that. One is haploid. I like the term haploid because haploid sounds like half. Many medical books designate haploid with just the lowercase letter N. And what is that number? You should know. Half the number of normal chromosomes equals 23. So that what? So that if the male sperm and the female egg cell, which is really called a secondary oocyte, if they unite in a process called fertilization, then that will restore the normal number. What's the normal number? It's called diploid. I like the word diploid because it has the root word for two. You're getting a double dose. One dose of chromosomes from mommy, one dose of chromosomes from daddy. It is abbreviated in many textbooks as 2N. But what is that number? That number is a total of 46 chromosomes or 23 pairs. And you know how important that is. If it's even off by one, that could result in significant effects on the baby. For example, there is a disorder where the mother contributes an extra chromosome number 21. So the baby ends up with three chromosomes 21. It's called trisomy 21. In garden variety English, you probably know that's called Down's syndrome. So just one extra chromosome can make a big difference. So could you imagine if we didn't do this process and we put, say, 46 chromosomes from daddy's sperm with 46 chromosomes from mommy's egg together, then we'd have 92 chromosomes. That would be a non-viable fetus. None of us would be here today if it weren't for meiosis. It has to happen. For my pea brain, fortunately, meiosis has two phases, meiosis phase number one and meiosis phase two. And each of those has a prophase, metaphase, anaphase, and a telophase. When you studied mitosis earlier in biology, maybe they taught you the mnemonic to remember the phases of mitosis. It's called PMAT. P-M-A-T, and that represents prophase, metaphase, anaphase, and telophase. So let's go ahead and look a little bit at this. There is an embedded animation from your textbook on this slide, and it's a really great slide. I hope they're working for you. It really goes through mitosis and meiosis in great detail, in more detail than you need for my course, but it's a wonderful review. This is a great summary slide that shows us the three key things that happen in meiosis that do not happen in mitosis. And these are the main things you need to know for this unit of this course. These are the things that allow us to end up with gametes, to end up with sperm and egg cells that are haploid, you know, that have half the number of normal chromosomes, and also allow us to end up with gametes that are unique so that we don't all end up the same. So what are the three key things that happen in meiosis that don't happen in mitosis? Number one, we have tetrad formation by synapses of homologous chromosomes. What in the world does that mean? First of all, homologous chromosomes means a pair of chromosomes, one from each parent. So down here in this figure on the lower left, here's a blue X-shaped chromosome. Let's say that's from daddy. And there's a red X-shaped chromosome. Let's say that's from mommy. So that's a pair of chromosomes, one from each parent, with, by the way, similar genes in a similar order. So maybe we're touching on these chromosomes now. These are coding for the eye colors. Maybe this is next gene is coding for hair color, maybe the next gene is coding for the size of the nose, but that's what homologous chromosomes refers to. What does tetrad formation by synapsis mean? Well, synapsis just means a coming together. If you synthesize something, you bring things together and create something. It's called a tetrad because the root word tetra means four. When you bring mommy's and daddy's chromosomes together by this process called synapsis, somebody looked at it under the microscope and said, oh, we have a total of four thread-like looking structures. I will call that a tetrad. So this is tetrad formation by synapsis of homologous chromosomes. The second thing that happens in meiosis that does not happen in mitosis is we have a physical crossing over of the chromatids. Look, here is a blue arm of one of daddy's chromatids crossing over the red arm, so to speak, of one of mommy's chromatids. It's a physical crossing over. That's the second key step you should know. And then the third thing that happens in meiosis that does not happen in mitosis is we have something called genetic recombination. So after the physical crossing over, the genes actually swap places. So now we have some red genes on daddy's blue chromosome, and we have some of daddy's blue genes on mommy's red chromosome. And this is what really makes us all different. I don't know about you, but recently when I was gathered around Thanksgiving table and I was looking at all my family and all my relatives, I was saying, thank goodness for genetic recombination. Thank goodness I'm not like them. I'm not talking about the way I look. I'm just saying, as far as the whole dysfunctional family thing going on, I don't know if any of y'all had that going on Thanksgiving. But for me, I was saying to myself, thank goodness for genetic recombination. Let's now talk about some of the details of spermatogenesis. I need to orient you first with the anatomy using your book's drawing. Over to your left here, what your book did was take out one piece of a seminiferous tubule and blew it up under really high power. My arrow tip is tracing on this thin gray structure. This is the connective tissue basement membrane of the seminiferous tubule that would go around in a great big circle. Underneath of that, shown in sort of a tannish orangish color, this is where we have the developing sperm cells. And at the very bottom of the slide, in this clear zone, is where we have the lumen of the seminiferous tubule. First of all, you must know sperm formation does not begin in a man until puberty with a star. The importance of that we already discussed. How does it happen? It all starts with a stem cell called a spermatogonium. The spermatogonium is located up near the basement membrane of the seminiferous tubule, and this stem cell has the full complement of chromosomes. It has 46 chromosomes. The first thing that stem cell does is it undergoes garden variety old-fashioned mitosis. It makes two identical copies of itself, and it plunks one copy of itself up near the basement membrane. So that what? So that a man can keep making sperm again another day. So a man can make sperm when he's 40, when he's 60, when he's 80, and beyond. What about the other cell that came out of this mitotic division? The other cell differentiates. That just means it grows up and changes into something different called a primary spermatocyte. And it's the primary spermatocyte that goes through meiosis one. And that's easier for my pea brain to remember. Primary means one, and the primary spermatocyte goes through meiosis one. And meiosis one has a prophase, metaphase, anaphase, and telophase. And this is where the magic happens. This is where all the action takes place that gives us exactly what we need. Remember, we need unique haploid cells. So this is where we have the three special processes called, number one, tetrad formation by synapsis, crossing over, and genetic recombination. So that by the end of meiosis one, we have really accomplished our mission. At the end of meiosis one, we are left with two cells called secondary spermatocytes, and each of them has 23 chromosomes. In other words, they are haploid. So we have accomplished our main mission that we needed to do. Then the two secondary spermatocytes go through meiosis two. And again, that's easy for my pea brain to remember. I have two secondary spermatocytes that go through meiosis two. And meiosis two is just like mitosis. It has a straightforward, old-fashioned prophase, metaphase, anaphase, and a telophase. And at the end of that, we have four, count them, four spermatids at the end of meiosis two. And the important thing is, each of those spermatids is haploid, and each of them with a star is unique. This leads us to the last phase of spermatogenesis, which is called spermiogenesis. In spermiogenesis, this is where the spermatids mature into sperm cells. So they grow their little tails on, they are pushed into the lumen of the seminiferous tubule, and that completes our process of spermatogenesis. So here's a common question I might ask you. In a man, how many sperm are produced from one spermatogonium? And the answer is, of course, four. And we're going to see that's very different than what we end up with in a female. So what controls the process? You might be thinking, well, how does that happen? Is it all just mumbo-jumbo magic? Does it happen just because he says it happens? No, it happens because it's under hormonal control, pretty much like the entire rest of our body is. What are the hormones that control spermatogenesis? There are three you must know. First comes FSH from the anterior pituitary gland, and FSH stimulates spermatogenesis. Then comes later LH from the anterior pituitary. LH stimulates the Leydig cells to produce testosterone. And that's easier for me to remember. LH starts with an L and Leydig cell starts with an L. So LH makes the Leydig cell produce testosterone. And testosterone is the third hormone that further stimulates some of the final stages of spermatogenesis. So those are the three hormones that control sperm formation. This is a great place to talk about testosterone. And let's review it here. What are, number one, the prenatal effects of testosterone? Prenatal means the before birth effect. So while we're in the room, not the room, the womb, while we're in the womb, what does testosterone do in a man? It leads to the male pattern of development of the reproductive system. It leads to the development of the male reproductive organs. What about at puberty. What does testosterone do at puberty? It causes further development and growth of those male sex organs. It helps to regulate sperm production, as we just discussed. And importantly, it helps with development and maintenance of what are called the male secondary sex characteristics. What are those? You should be able to write at least three down here, and you probably learned them in eighth grade health class. That includes things like bigger muscle mass, broader shoulders, deeper voice, the hair pattern that males have, which is different than females. So, very important effects of this hormone. That reminds me of something, by the way. I was channel surfing the other day, and just ended up on this channel where I guess the female bodybuilders were, and they were interviewing the winners of the female bodybuilding contest. And one of the questions they always ask the winners are, have you ever used male sex hormones, the bodybuilding sex hormones? And you know, women, of course, they start growing hair, you can have that removed. If the breasts shrink, you can always get breast implants. But the one thing they can't fake is this. So they go to the woman and they interview the winner and they say, have you ever used male bodybuilding sex hormones? And she goes, no, I've never used those bodybuilding hormones. And I knew right away, of course she did, because it caused deepening of her voice. And that's something they can't really fake and they can't really reverse either, by the way. What are the other effects of testosterone? Well, we just talked about protein synthesis. It is used to build muscles and bones. And also it is for libido, which is commonly called sex drive. We just made a sperm, so what does a sperm look like? Let's talk about sperm morphology. I'm going to break it down into a head and into a tail. The head has two main pieces I want you to know from my course. Number one, the nucleus. That's where all the chromosomes are. And then on top of the head is a special piece called the acrosome. I love that word. Acro means on the top, like the Acropolis in Greece. I think it's a building on top of a hill. And some means body. So on the top of the head is the acrosome, and that also is a very important structure. That is packed with enzymes that allow the sperm to penetrate the shell of the egg cell, if you will. The term for an egg cell is oocyte. Oo in Greek means egg and cyte means cell. So the acrosome is sort of like a detonator or a blasting cap. It allows this sperm to punch through the shell of the egg, if you will. The other major part of the sperm is the tail. The tail has this big, long piece that sort of wags and helps the sperm move along its way. This is commonly called the flagellum. As a matter of fact, the sperm is the only cell in the human body that has a flagellum. The other piece of the tail is called the middle piece, and in the middle piece is where we have the mitochondria that form ATP for energy. So I think of the middle piece kind of like a battery pack that helps to wag the tail, so to speak. We have discussed, of course, the process of sperm formation, which takes roughly about 2 months to finish the process, and on average, a male will produce roughly 300 million sperm per day. Once we made the sperm, though, we got to get it to where it's going. So we have to trace the pathway of sperm flow, not just through the testes, but on its entire journey. This slide just deals with the flow of sperm through the testis. So let's go ahead and do that. These next series of slides are really just where a whole bunch of parts are connected, A's connected to B, connected to C, so really just a laundry list kind of a deal. Let's do the pathway through the testis on this slide. Remember, it starts with production of sperm in the seminiferous tubules. From there, the sperm are pushed into a next set of tubules called straight tubules. The straight tubules take the sperm straight into an inner network of tubules called the reti testes. Recall that your root word reti means a network. And then from the reti testes, the sperm are pushed into the next set of ducts called efferent ducts, which please think of efferent ducts as exit ducts, and that's how the sperm will exit the testicle and head on to the next location in the pathway of flow. Before I leave this simple flow slide, I want to tell you a true story that helps me remember one of these root words. The root word reti, of course, means a network or a lacy-like pattern. And recently I went on a trip to Disney World and I took the Animal Kingdom ride and I was riding in the safari truck and the lady was pointing out all the animals. You know, there's a lion, there's a tiger, there's a giraffe or whatever. I'm saying, well, that's just great. I could see all that at Zoo World right here in town. And then she stops the truck and she says, hey, everybody, take a look at that giraffe. Does anybody know the scientific name of a giraffe? And all of a sudden, I felt like I was under a lot of pressure, you know, because I'm a biology type. Now, I'm just a human biologist, so I don't really know a whole lot about critters. So she asked if anyone knew the name, and I drew a blank, and nobody knew the name. And she said, well, take a look at that giraffe. Do you see the brown sort of checks and then the intertwined, lacy, pale, yellowish, tan pattern that goes all around and in between the brown checks? Well, that's how the giraffe got its scientific name. And the giraffe's real name is called Giraffis reticularis or something like that. And she said, because retic means a network. And I'm thinking to myself, you got to be kidding me. I can't even get away from anatomy when I'm in Disney World. In any case, that helps me remember the root word reti means a network. And if you're a snake person, that's how a reticulated python got its name as well, because of the reticular pattern on its skin. Well, let's get back to tracing the pathway of sperm flow. Continuing on this slide, let's trace the pathway of sperm flow. From the efferent ducts, the sperm exit the testicle and enter the next series of ducts that are located in an organ called the epididymis. Epi means on, and didymis in Greek, at least one translation, is testicle. So epididymis means on the testicle. In this drawing, notice it is a comma-shaped organ that lies along the posterior border of the testis. So it hugs the back of each testicle like a comma shape. And it's mostly just made up of coiled ducts. And some genius called the coiled ducts within the epididymis the ductus epididymis. Those ducts do contain smooth muscle, and smooth muscle is designed to move things, and the smooth muscle does push the sperm in the proper direction along its journey. More importantly, you should know that the epididymis is an organ which is the site of sperm maturation with a star. Sperm do not acquire their motility. They do not acquire their ability to move on their own until they reach the epididymis. It takes about 2 weeks of work inside the epididymis before the sperm can wag their own tails. Sperm can be stored in the epididymis for up to several months as well. All up until they reach the epididymis, the sperm are just really getting pushed along by fluid pressure. Here is a beautiful gross anatomy picture. I love this picture. This is the testis with the tunica albuginea. This is the epididymis, the comma-shaped organ hugging the backside of the testicle. For interest's sake, the epididymis does have a head, a body, and a tail, but it's just seen beautifully here in this gross anatomy picture. Where does the sperm go from here? So we're just following the sperm from one place to the next. And really, the big picture is, it's just a whole series of interconnected tubules. It's like angel hair pasta. And you could kind of just grab onto this thing and unravel the whole thing and unwind it. But it's just a series of interconnected tubules. So, from the epididymis, the sperm next enters up into another duct, and it goes up or ascends into this duct, which is called the vas deferens. Some people call it the ductus deferens, but all my friends, when we're out on the weekends drinking soda, we all call this the vas deferens. The vas deferens ascends upwards from the epididymis, passes up into a very important cord-like structure called the spermatic cord, where it's headed towards the interior of the male's body. Within the vas deferens, the sperm can also be stored for several months. The vas deferens also has smooth muscle to help push the sperm in the proper direction. And the vas deferens, as we will see, eventually empties into the next ducts called the ejaculatory ducts. This is a great place to stop and talk about something clinically relevant called a vasectomy. What's a vasectomy? It's an ectomy that means a cutting of the vas deferens. It's a procedure for male sterilization, and it's very effective. Is it 100% effective? No, it's not. Hardly anything's 100% in life. How is it done? Well, under local anesthesia, they make a small incision in the scrotum, and then they fish out the spermatic cord. They make a little cut in the spermatic cord. They find the vas deferens, and then they take that and cut it and tie it off. Now, a friend of mine had this done. They told him that it wasn't going to hurt, but he told me it did hurt. Also, what's a man supposed to do to make sure the procedure worked? The man is supposed to go back for a follow-up visit and give a sample to see if the vasectomy actually worked. Well, my friend forgot to go back for the follow-up visit and give the sample. And my friend had another baby. So don't forget to tell your male patients about the follow-up visit. Let's continue on by talking about this spermatic cord. We just mentioned that the sperm was flowing up the vas deferens up into a structure called the spermatic cord. You must know this structure inside and out to understand the male reproductive anatomy. What is inside this cord-like structure? Well, everything passing back and forth from the testicles is in this cord-like structure, including a testicular artery, a plexus or a network of veins, some autonomic nerves, and that shouldn't surprise you that they're autonomic nerves because everything down here is pretty much under cruise control, some lymphatic vessels as well. And let's just stop right there, because some of you are freaking out. You're saying, oh my gosh, there's six different things on this list. How am I going to remember all the stuff in the spermatic cord? Well, the first four things I just told you, you already know. I've mentioned it before in the course. These four things always travel together, pretty much, in the human body. They taught me a mnemonic in med school called VANL. V-A-N-L, for vein, arteries, nerves, and lymph, because they almost always travel together. So the top four I already mentioned, that's easy. What are the two other things that you have to remember that are in the spermatic cord? Well, the vas deferens is in there carrying the sperm up their spermatic cord. And then something else that we talked about on one of the first slides in this unit, there's a muscle, skeletal muscle, that's like a crank or a chain that elevates or lowers that testicle to keep at the proper temperature, called the cremaster muscle. So those are the six things in the spermatic cord that everyone has to know. Where does the spermatic cord go? It passes through a canal in the man's groin area called the inguinal canal. That's located in the anterior abdominal wall. Again, I like that name, inguinal, because it sounds like and it means the in the groin canal. I'm going to show you a couple of pictures of it. Here is an anterior view of the scrotum cut open. Here on our right on this slide is a testicle with the spermatic cord with all of its six goodies going up and down in it. And the spermatic cord is entering a little tunnel-like opening and going into the inguinal canal. So this is a nice anterior view of where these structures, including the vas deferens, are headed. By the way, in a man, this inguinal canal is the canal where the testicle and the spermatic cord drop into the scrotal sac during development. This canal is always a weak spot in a man. It is the common source of a hernia in a man. What is a hernia in general? A hernia means a part of someone's body is pooching into another part of the body where it doesn't belong. It almost always refers to a piece of the intestine. And what happens in a man if he strains or lifts too hard is under pressure, some small intestine will get forced down into the inguinal canal right about there. And they call that an inguinal hernia. Sometimes the small intestine can get pushed way down into the scrotum near the testicle, and yeah, that's uncomfortable, and that's called a scrotal hernia. So this explains why when a man goes to the doctor, goes for routine physical, he gets checked. And what does the doctor do? The doctor takes one of his fingers, he finds this little opening of the inguinal canal. The doctor puts his finger here and tells the man, take a cough. Why is he doing that? Because when you cough, if there is some intestine in there, you could actually feel the herniated intestine banging against your finger. Furthermore, sometimes the doctor will take his or her stethoscope and listen to the scrotum. Now, why is the doctor doing that? Is something wrong with the doctor? Maybe. But on the other hand, they might actually be listening for bowel sounds in the scrotum. That's one way you could diagnose a scrotal hernia. Here's another view taken from the muscle chapter of the textbook. And this is beautiful because it shows you the opening into the inguinal canal. And then on the other side, it shows you the spermatic cord going into the inguinal canal. And again, this is a permanent weak spot that happens during development or forms during development in a man's body. We're now going to continue to follow the pathway of flow of sperm. Remember, we just went up the vas deferens, up through the spermatic cord, and now what you're seeing is a posterior view of a man's urinary bladder as well as his prostate gland, and here comes the vas deferens. The vas deferens loops around the ureter. That's very important, and you should write it down. The vas deferens loops around the ureter. It joins up with the duct of the seminal vesicle so that the union of the vas deferens and the duct of the seminal vesicle, they form something called the ejaculatory ducts. And the ejaculatory ducts empty into a man's prostatic urethra. That's the first part of a man's urethra, located, of course, in the prostate gland. Since we mentioned the duct of the seminal vesicles as it contributed to formation of the ejaculatory duct, this is a great place to talk about the seminal vesicles. Again, what we have here is a posterior view of a man. Here is his big muscular urinary bladder. Here is his prostate where we just emptied the ejaculatory ducts into the prostatic urethra. And then here we have a pair of pouch-like organs posterior to the base of a man's urinary bladder, and these are called the seminal vesicles. To me, they kind of look like a pair of bunny ears behind the man's bladder. But what's in there? What's the importance of the seminal vesicles? These are the first accessory sex glands that we're talking about in this unit. They secrete an alkaline fluid that contains fructose, right, that's sugar, for ATP production. So look at the beauty of this accessory sex gland. It's making a juice to help the sperm in two ways. Number one, obviously sugar, fructose for energy production so the sperm could swim on its journey. Number two, alkaline. Why alkaline? A common theme in anatomy is whenever we're making alkaline something, it's usually designed to neutralize something acidic later on down the road. And it just so turns out that a woman's vagina is sort of a harsh environment, and it's acidic, and it's deadly to the sperm. So it's nice to have an alkaline fluid to help to neutralize the harsh acidic environment of a woman's vagina. The next accessory sex gland that the man will talk about is called the prostate gland. Please do not call it the prostrate gland. That is incorrect. It means something totally different in English. You could look it up, but please say it correctly or they'll wonder where you took your course. The prostate gland, shown here again from a posterior view, is about a golf ball-sized gland, kind of shaped like a donut. It's found just inferior to the urinary bladder. It surrounds the prostatic urethra, the first part of a man's urethra. That's the hole in the donut, if you will. And yes, the prostate gland enlarges with age. Most men are going to face something called benign prostatic hypertrophy, or BPH. And what happens is that prostate tissue squeezes on the man's prostatic urethra, and it makes him feel like he has to go to the bathroom all the time. He has trouble starting and stopping his stream. He just gets little bits out that just dribble out drops at a time, and it's extremely annoying for the man. You'll see many male patients with that, and there are drugs designed to treat that disorder. What does the prostate gland make? It makes a special juice. Remember, this is an accessory sex gland. It's shooting juice into the tube to help the sperm be healthy along its journey. Look what it puts into the tube. It secretes a slightly acidic fluid that contains citric acid, PSA, and seminal plasmin. Let me break this down one at a time. First of all, some of you are getting upset because I said it's slightly acidic. Don't worry, it's only very slightly acidic. It will not harm the sperm, and in the end, trust me, semen is alkaline, so you don't have to worry about that. What about citric acid? What is the purpose of citric acid? You should write it down. If you remember, the Krebs cycle is also called the citric acid cycle. You'll remember that the purpose of citric acid is to give the sperm a little kick of energy. So citric acid is for a kick of energy for the sperm. PSA stands for prostate-specific antigen. It's actually useful to measure in a male to look for prostate cancer. In a man, the PSA is typically elevated if he has cancer, although in recent times the value of that blood test has come into question. The last ingredient from the prostate gland I want you to know is called seminal plasmin. It's a beautiful ingredient. You should write down right here next to it, it is a natural antibiotic, and that's beautiful to have because, again, along the journey, the sperm is going to possibly encounter the harsh environment of a woman's vagina, which does have a lot of bacteria. So it's nice to have this antibacterial agent called seminal plasmin from the prostate gland. The last accessory male sex glands we'll talk about are called either bulbourethral glands, or all my friends on the weekends when we're out having soda, we call them Cowper's glands. Here they are again from the posterior cutaway view, just below the prostate gland, in between a man's thighs. There is a thin, muscular, membranous sort of diaphragm. It's actually called the urogenital diaphragm. It's a thin layer of muscle between a man's thighs. The prostate gland sits right on top of it. The way I kind of remember it is I just think of this thin membranous muscle like a trampoline, and I just bounce a golf ball. That's supposed to be the prostate gland. I bounce a golf ball on top of the trampoline, and it kind of helps me remember the anatomy here. Well, Cowper's glands are two pea-sized glands located right inside that muscular trampoline, if you will. And they secrete an alkaline mucus. Why? Alkaline to neutralize acid on down the end of the road, and also mucus, once again, to lubricate and protect. This is a wonderful gross anatomy slide, a posterior view of the male accessory organs that we just talked about. Try to locate them and make an analogy to the diagrams that we studied. It really is a beautiful dissection. This is also a wonderful overview. After I've given this talk to my face-to-face classes, several students have often said, I'm having a hard time putting that whole flow together. So I picked this drawing out of your book and I labeled it appropriately, and it really shows you the long, tortuous, convoluted pathway that sperm takes. I will trace it briefly here on this slide. Remember, we start in the testicles, we go to the epididymis, up the vas deferens, up the spermatic cord and into the body. We loop around the ureter, mark that spot. We join with the duct of the seminal vesicle. We dump into the ejaculatory ducts, then into the prostatic urethra. Eventually that goes into a part of the urethra in the trampoline called the membranous urethra. Then that goes into the part of the urethra called the penile urethra, and out it goes. So that really is a nice overview to trace the total pathway of sperm flow. Well, we've made some sperm and some fluid. And what is that combination of sperm and fluid called? It's called semen. Semen is not just sperm. Semen is a mixture of sperm and seminal fluid. What is seminal fluid? It's the fluids from the secretions of all the accessory sex glands we just talked about. Seminal fluid consists of secretions from, number one, the seminal vesicles. And if I ask you, seminal vesicles make most of the seminal fluid with a star next to it. Some of the fluid also comes from the prostate gland. Additional contributions are made by Cowper's glands. And believe it or not, the seminiferous tubules don't just make sperm. They make a little bit of fluid as well. So some of the semen contains fluid from the seminiferous tubules as well. One of the important key points here is in the end, this whole mixture is slightly alkaline. Alkaline why? To neutralize the acidic environment that the sperm may encounter along its journey to protect it. Let's go ahead and take a look at the male urethra in a little bit of detail. Here is a sort of a long way section through all parts of a man's urethra. Your book says it's approximately an 8-inch long passageway for both urine and semen. Their first part is the part in the prostate called the prostatic urethra. It's roughly 1 inch in length. Then there's the little piece of the urethra that goes through the muscular trampoline I've been referring to. That's really called the membranous urethra. Then the part of the urethra that goes through the penis, some genius called that, you guessed it, the penile urethra. This is a good place to ask you a question that I've asked on the test before. Who is more likely to get a urinary tract infection, a male or a female? And the answer is in the anatomy on this slide. The answer is a female is much more likely to get a urinary tract infection than a male. Why? One reason is a female's urethra is much, much, much shorter. So the bacteria have a much shorter distance to travel before they get into the bladder, for example, and develop into a bladder infection. In a man, they got to travel a long way and encounter a lot of non-specific defenses and other immune defenses along their journey, so a man is protected more from infection than a woman. Also, the opening of a woman's urethra is in an area around her vagina and around her anus where there's lots of bacteria, so that's another reason why women have a lot more UTIs than men do. I've put little red boxes around the three pieces of the urethra, so you could work through that on an animated PowerPoint at home if you wish. Likewise, we'll take a look at the penis. The penis has three simple parts. It is divided into a root. The root of the penis is the part of the penis that is rooted into the body wall, again, right in between a man's thighs where that urogenital diaphragm is located. Then the main part of this organ and almost every other organ in anatomy is called the body. So there's the body of the penis highlighted with a red box on this animated PowerPoint. And then finally, the distal or far end of the penis where it's sort of dilated. Many books call it an acorn shape or a cone shaped. That is called the glans penis. On the next slide, we're going to take a cross-section right through the body of a man's penis. Here's a mini cross-section on this slide. Let's take it out, blow it up, and slap it on a slide. And here is a cross-section through a body of the penis. What is inside there? Well, there are a total of 1, 2, 3 cylindrical masses of erectile tissue. Each is surrounded by its own tough white connective tissue collagen coat that is once again called a tunica albuginea. So in 3D, these are like cylinders, three long cylinders of erectile tissue. And what is erectile tissue? It's basically just blood-filled sinuses which have the ability to hold blood during an erection. Remember, during the endocrine unit, we mentioned that this is where nitric oxide is released from the endothelial cells of the blood vessel walls. It causes dilation of the blood vessels. They become engorged with blood, and that is what causes an erection in a man. Let's go ahead and break this down further. There are two cylindrical masses of erectile tissue on the top. Technically, in anatomical terms, they're actually located dorsally. These are called the corpora cavernosa. Corpse means a body. Cavernous means cavernous because they're big, dilated, cavernous blood vessels. So these are the corpora cavernosa. Again, dorsal paired erectile tissue masses. Then down here at the bottom, which is really anatomically correctly called ventral, we have a single mass of erectile tissue called the corpus spongiosum. The corpus spongiosum with a U helps me remember this for both lab and lecture. Because the corpus spongiosum, there's only one of them. In Greek, did you ever notice when they use the letter U, it usually means one, like a unicycle has one wheel? Well, the corpus spongiosum, there's only one of them, and it's at the bottom. Furthermore, this ventral erectile tissue mass surrounds something else with a U called the penile urethra. So I remember the corpus spongiosum, only one of them at the bottom, and it's the one that contains the urethra with a U. So the U helps me remember this stuff long term. The corpus spongiosum is actually what extends out distally and ends as that acorn-shaped part of the penis called the glans penis. Here's a cross-section in gross anatomy of the body of the penis showing the paired corpora cavernosa and the single corpus spongiosum with the urethra running right through it. So that's a really beautiful picture and gives you a really good idea of what erectile tissue looks like in real life, so to speak. Finally, we'll end with the glans penis. The glans penis, the slang term for that is the head of the penis. It is the enlarged distal end of the corpus spongiosum. It is covered by a loosely fitting, what's called a prepuce. Your book calls it a prepuce. I don't know why, because everyone in the real world just calls that the foreskin. And then finally, of course, we have the penile urethra, which does go through the corpus spongiosum, including the glans penis portion. Externally, it's visible as a small vertical slit, and there's a name for that. It's called the external urethral orifice, and that, of course, is an opening where both urine and semen may emerge.